Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this evening I thought I would go over some of the fundamentals of meditation practice. Thought it would be useful. I think one of the, as a beginning to recollect that the word that maybe would be most equated with the English word meditation that was used in the time of the Buddha would be called bhavana. And bhavana is interesting in the sense of its kind of the scope of its meaning, because sometimes meditation, just the word seems to be pretty narrow in its scope or its application, usually sort of sitting meditation. And bhavana has more of a, say, literally it means to bring into being. And in particular, bringing into being attention, awareness, bringing into being wholesome, clear states of mind, clear states of being. So that, it has a bit broader feel to it. And I think that's important to recognize, because oftentimes we box ourselves in with the how we conceive of the practice, how we conceive of meditation. And so that when we consider the different ways that we can be bringing into being qualities of clarity and stability within the mind. Of course, one of them is the sitting meditation, but it's a lot of it is around the ways that we apply the mind. Another word that they oftentimes use in terms of translating the word bhavana is cultivation, cultivating. I think it's an apt image with the sense of cultivation, being an agrarian image, and it's something that certainly the Ajahn Chah used many, many times, of the sense of, you know, what do we do in practice? And it's like planting a tree. You know, first you have to dig the soil, prepare the soil. You need to bring some kind of fertilizer, you need to water it on a regular basis, you have to look after the weeds and the bugs and make sure that it doesn't overwhelm the tree. And then the tree will grow on its own. You can't really force it to grow at the pace that you want it, and you force it to give fruit in some way that is not in the nature of the tree. And sort of like if you plant a blackberry bush and hope for apples, I mean, it's not going to work. So that recognizing that there's causes and conditions that we put into place in our practice, in our cultivation. And when the causes and conditions are there, then there'll be a result. So similarly with our practice, paying attention to those different causes. It isn't just a matter of sitting down, trying to force the mind into a place of peacefulness and understanding. There needs to be a kind of a broad sense of stability and clarity, steadiness of attention, reflective investigation of the content of the mind, the impingement that it receives, and then reflecting on the kind of habits of mind that we bring to our practice. So there tends to be a fair bit of perspective that we have to have in order for the practice to really flourish. So when we practice meditation, beginning with the establishing of attention on a meditation object, generally I encourage and teach mindfulness of breathing, mostly because that's what I like, and I'm most familiar with that. So I can speak with a certain level of comfort when we use the breath in a certain way. This is what you can expect. Of course, there's many different meditation techniques in the Buddhist world, and each individual has to be willing to experiment and try out what is useful and beneficial for oneself. And at different times we'll actually need to use different tools. We have to have some skill in using different methods, because inevitably we meet up with a variety of obstacles, the reality of having a human mind is that it's impossible to sustain interest and enthusiasm for one thing for a long period of time. So that just having some flexibility in how we approach our practice, and developing a skill with a few different ways of helping to settle the mind. But the basic principles are somewhat the same in terms of when we think of mindfulness of breathing, then it's a good template for how we learn how to apply our attention to the meditation. That learning how to tune into the rhythm of the body as it breathes in, as it breathes out, paying attention to posture. It really doesn't matter what kind of meditation method one uses. If one's overly rigid in one's posture, overly tense, the mind's going to be kind of tense. I mean, it's just as one sets the conditions for that kind of energy. If you're forcing, pushing, tense, tight, in terms of your physical posture, chances are that's what the mind is going to display. Or if one is overly lax in applying effort to sitting up straight, keeping a nice, erect, alert posture, if the body is slumping, mind will probably slump as well. It's kind of ordinary. But when we bring attention to the physical posture, bring a sense of kind of an energetic but calm and steady application of effort to being really present with our posture, you'll find that translates into an alert and present mental state. It's quite natural. It's quite ordinary. So that paying attention to posture, paying attention to what does the body feel like? Does it feel balanced? How do we balance it? How do we bring a sense of alertness? Because sometimes especially if one's sitting, it's helpful to use, unless one's got really good posture and ability to sit in, a full lotus, half lotus position, it's kind of hard to keep the back upright. It's helpful to use a cushion, just to have that extra height that's given to the back. allowing the posture to rise up out of the pelvis, out of the sitting posture, holding that posture, keeping the belly kind of soft and relaxed, and then the shoulders a bit back, not, you know, kind of like a military posture. What it does is open the chest, and then you can breathe more fully, and keeping the chest really open when one breathes in and breathes out. There's a smooth in-breath, a smooth out-breath. There's a sense of fullness and spaciousness that comes in the posture. And again, that translates into a fullness and spaciousness of the mind. And that's useful. Paying attention to one's head, in that it's tilted a little bit forward, so that one's gazing in front of oneself about 3-4 feet. If the head is tilted back, then over time it'll just feel like a crick in the neck. And then, of course, if your chin is folded on your chest, head is looking down somewhere around your elbows, you're probably asleep. So that's not useful. So that paying attention to posture and the meditation, it's, you know, again, you're putting causal conditions in place. If the ground isn't prepared and you just plunk a seed in the ground, then it may or may not grow. But if the ground is prepared really, really well, you're upping the percentage rates of success of the plant growing that you're putting in the ground. So that similarly, that paying attention to the physical posture, grounding awareness in the body, using awareness to not just at the beginning of the meditation, but really grounding awareness in the posture, in the body, and checking in to the body really consistently, that will bear fruit in the meditation, that the mind will become more settled and consistent. The mind has a place to land. And the Buddha had tremendous ability in being able to give similes and images. And when the Buddha tried to find a simile for how fast the mind moves, he said, you know, it's really impossible to find a simile or an image that can aptly describe how quickly the mind can change. And everybody's mind is like that. It changes quickly, moods come up, thoughts come in, awareness can be here this mental moment and the next mental moment, who knows where it's gone. It can change so quickly. So that when that's the case, then it's necessary to rely on, rather than just some sort of mental effort, but the grounding of awareness in the body helps to provide an anchor. And an anchor is very helpful for something that's moving really quickly. So that mindfulness of the body, paying attention to the sensation of the breath as it comes in, the breath as it goes out, tuning in to the different areas where one experiences the breath. What does it feel like at the tip of the nose? What's it feel like at the back of the throat? What's it feel like at the area of the chest? What's it feel like at the abdomen? What does the breath feel like on the in-breath? What's it feel like on the out-breath? What does it feel like in relationship to the rest of the body? Tuning in, questioning, am I attentive? Especially as we become more, a bit more used to meditation, then we oftentimes forget to just check in. We start doing it as a something that's quite habitual. You know, and sometimes we develop good habits and sometimes we develop pretty poor habits. So that without that checking in and reflecting and paying attention, it's easy to miss how the mind drifts, how the mind wanders, how the mind loses its base of clarity. So that tuning into the breath, tuning into the posture, and then reflecting, questioning. As we sustain the attention on the breath, the reflections that we do are really not all that, it doesn't have to be all that complicated. The Buddha gives, he gives different, many, many different templates for investigation. Traditionally, the most fundamental and useful basis of investigation are around anicchang, dukkhang, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. And these are basically the essence of insight and understanding. And there's many ways to approach that or to reach that or to utilize that. In meditation, there's two fundamental ways of applying the mind. One is samatha, the other is vipassana. And the samatha is the tranquility, settling, stability aspect of application of mind. The vipassana is like a investigative, reflective, contemplative way of applying the mind. And of course, there's not some major barrier between them. It isn't as if they don't support and feed each other. But there are these somewhat different ways of applying the mind, and they do rely on each other, they support each other, and it's important to consciously apply the mind and recognize what one is doing. If you're applying the mind in a way to help the mind to settle, to become steady and clear, you know, it's a samatha object. It's a samatha way of practicing. You're developing a tranquility and kind of a peacefulness of mind. The vipassana element is the investigative, reflective way of directing the thought processes or directing attention, recognizing impermanence, recognizing change. Recognizing, as Ajahn Chah would use, he said, the tendency for all phenomena to be uncertain, unsure, whether it's internal or external, whether it's mental or physical. There's this endless manifestation of uncertainty, unsure. It's changing. It's impermanent. It's inconstant. And that's just the way of nature. And that's actually a really important insight for a freedom of heart to really manifest. We have to align ourselves with what is in accordance with nature, what's in accordance with the true nature of things. If we're hoping somehow that we're going to practice and train and cultivate and not have to experience the truth of nature, the true nature of things, then it's not going to work. That we have to be accepting of the fact of the inconstant nature of things. We inhabit bodies that are aging, they're changing, they're getting older, they're subject to illness, they're subject to death. And there's a tremendous freedom when we're willing to accept that, allow that to be true for us. There's a tremendous amount of fear and denial that most human beings go through because they don't want it to be that way. Don't want to be in an aging body. Don't want to experience illness. Get upset and averse because it shouldn't be that way. But that, again, the source of peace that the Buddha gives to us is not because we can prove to be the exception to the natural law. It's by really understanding and surrendering to the true nature of things. And this is a, you know, it's a fundamental insight. And the being able to approach that through that investigation of anicca. Oh, this is inconstant. And so that what's it feel like in the body? You sit up straight, you pay attention to the breath coming in, going out, and then you check your body, how you feel, what it's like, and then you feel, how did I end up slumping here again? Leaning over to the side? How'd that happen? Well, it was inconstant. It was impermanent. It was not sure. So that it's displaying that truth. But of course, when one recognizes, okay, reestablishing attention, reestablishing the intention to be present, to apply oneself skillfully. And the same with the mind. You think, okay, I'm just going to pay attention to the breath coming in, breath coming out. How simple can that be? And then, one ends up, planning for some fantasy for the future or rehashing some event that took place, was inconsequential at the time and is still inconsequential. And it wasn't worth the energy at any time, and we keep going over it. And what happened to that intention? Well, it was impermanent. And of course, again, that sense of that unsatisfactory nature of it. It's unsatisfactory that our minds don't comply with our wishes and desires. It's really unsatisfactory that we keep obsessing over things that aren't really all that important. And it certainly, it's not in displaying not self. Fortunately, it's not self. If it were our permanent, enduring self, to be scattered, confused, and obsessive, well, that's hopeless. But it's not self. And so you can take delight in that. Okay, this is not self. Whatever arises, it establishes itself for a while, and then it dissipates. And our opportunity for peace, our opportunity for freedom, comes from seeing. Okay, this is seeing that inconstant nature, seeing that uncertain nature of things. And again, whether it's internal or external, whether it's mental or physical, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, that's its nature. And it's in that seeing clearly that we can then release, we can relinquish, we can let go. And of course, that's the whole purpose of that, is to be able to come to a place of non-attachment, of non-clinging. But that's coming at that through understanding and awareness and recognizing that aspect of dukkha. There's a certain level of imperfection, unsatisfactoriness that we recognize and see that allows us to relinquish. In the description of the word dukkha, in its its roots within the language. In the Visuddhimagga, Acharya Buddhaghosa breaks down the word, and it's like on a cart, the wheel, or the axle, and where it goes into the hole, where the axle turns. And it's not a perfect fit. And when it's not a perfect fit, it isn't completely smooth. That's the nature of existence. And there's never this perfect fit. It's either squeaky or a bit sort of resistance or a bit something grinding away. When I was over in the coast the other day, what came to mind was when talking about that aspect of dukkha and a description of dukkha from where I grew up. So you think, well, you know, when you have a wheel turning, it's nice smooth movement, and it kind of rolls along really nicely and smoothly. But I was thinking of in the winter time where I grew up. Once you get down around, it's kind of minus 35, minus 40, minus 45, then the tires of your car when you in the morning you start your car starts easily because you've got block heaters and whatnot. But the wheels, the air in them at that temperature, it sort of it contracts. And then the weight of the tires ends up, what you've got is you've got a kind of flat bit on the bottom of the tire, and it's frozen like that. And then your car starts going, and of course, clump, clump, clump. Until the tires warm up enough so that they start to go round again. That's dukkha. it's not quite so smooth. It doesn't quite work so well. And that's the nature of dukkha. Things aren't always perfect. They aren't always this nice smooth fit. And one of the great sources of dukkha and frustration is actually expecting things to be that way, and expecting things to work, expecting things to be perfect, expecting things to there to be no difficulty, no obstacle. And it's like expecting a human body to not get ill, to not age, to not get tired. All of that is a source of dukkha. So whether it's on the internal, external, physical, mental, the truth of dukkha. And isn't there to make us, you obsess over it and get depressed by it. It's just sort of, oh, this is the way it is. When it's winter in northern Canada, this is what the tires do. you expect it to be something different, it's going to create problems. Yeah. And it's all workable. These are kind of natural laws. It's not self. So these, when we reflect and investigate, then we can understand the nature of things. And this is where, in terms of the progression of cultivation, the Buddha lays out the path of training so that there is a fundamental steadiness, peacefulness, clarity of heart, so that one, there's the arising of knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. And so that's a necessary aspect of our cultivation. Developing our mindfulness, settling the mind, bringing a foundation of tranquility and clarity so that we can see things in their true nature, in the scriptural language. Yatha bhuta jnana dasanam. Knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. So that in order to really see that clearly, one does need to investigate. Okay, am I seeing things in their true nature? Am I seeing things as they truly are? Or am I, because our habit is to see things through our preference, either through how we prefer it in terms of when there's a desire, a liking, a wanting things to be a certain way, to fit into how we like things, or according to our dislikes. You know, when we look around, when we have aversion and ill will as a foundation of our the mood of the mind at the time, you know, it doesn't take very long to look around and find things that are really irritating. I mean, it's just that doesn't take that long at all. But that's, we're not really seeing things as they truly are. We're seeing things according to our aversion, according to our dislike. So that sense of being able to step back from our biases, our views and opinions, our attachments, our habits of mind, and learning to see things as they are. And of course, then we step back from those biases, those habits, and start to invest. What is their true nature? What is knowledge and vision of the way things truly are? And it comes back again. Okay, there, a template for that viewing, seeing things as impermanent, as dukkha, as anatta, anicca, dukkha, anatta. And then that's a way that we can then step back, we can relinquish, we can release. There can be a letting go. And when there's a letting go, there's an ease and a peace. So that fundamental foundations of bhavana, of cultivation, are in order to foster that ability to settle and allow the mind to become more peaceful, a samatha practice, and vipassana, insight, that reflective, that investigative ability. And that's a different level of peace, when there's a real stability and solid peace that arises through insight. These are just some thoughts this evening around the fundamentals of practice. I'll offer that for reflection this evening. Tamasaya